You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
For many Muslims, post 9/11 America has been an uninviting place to live. Stephen Salisbury says that law enforcement agents have disrupted the lives of many innocent people in the name of national security and maintaining freedom, but have uncovered few real threats. Mr. Salisbury is the senior cultural writer for the Philadelphia Inquirer, where he has been a reporter for three decades and was a Pulitzer Prize finalist as part of a team that investigated local election fraud in 1995. His new book, Muhammad's Ghosts, An American Story of Love and Fear in the Homeland, tells the story of a raid on a mosque in Philadelphia in 2004. It's published by Nation Books. I'm very pleased to bring Stephen Salisbury to our show. Hello.
Hello, Leonard. Thank you for having me. I appreciate it.
The raid was on a small mosque. What was it? The Ansarullah Mosque?
Ansarullah. It means helpers of God.
And it's in a working-class Philadelphia neighborhood. I don't even remember reading about it at the time. Did it become a national story?
No, it didn't. It was a very small mosque of, at its height, maybe 200 congregants attended services. When the raid occurred in May of 2004, received a certain amount of play. Certainly, it received local play. It was a massive raid of over 100 members of the Joint Terrorism Task Force
for a mosque that had 200 members.
Yeah, well, they raided the mosque and went through everything and carted out boxes of papers and cassettes of the Sheikh Mohammed Gharib's sermons and papers of all kinds. They went through the home of the imam and his wife and two daughters next door in the same way. But at the same time that the raid occurred, which I should also say was featured agents wearing bulletproof vests and deploying bomb-sniffing dogs through the mosque, which absolutely horrified people in the community.
What reason was given for the raid?
Well, it was at the time. Now, I should say I was not covering this particular story at the time. And when it did first happen, there was very little explanation. In fact, going back from 2004, we can see even now with the in the wake of the smoky SUV Times Square car bomb attempt, very difficult to extract information from investigators unless it's information that they want to share for whatever reason. At the time of the raid in Philadelphia that I write about, it was almost impossible to get any information. The federal authorities said, no, it wasn't a terrorism investigation, even though it was led by the Joint Terrorism Task Force. Then it turned out they were operating with a warrant seeking financial records. And then there was vague discussion by the federal authorities that the Internal Revenue Service was had prompted the raid. But it never really became clear what the reasons for the raid were. And I should say also, at the same time that this mosque was being raided, the Sheikh was not there. He was with his wife, and they were dropping their seventh grade daughter off at school several miles away. And as they did this, as they let this little girl out of their car and she went up the steps into the school, federal agents descended on the car in front of hundreds of parents and children and teachers and arrested the imam and put him in a car and took him off to prison, and he never returned home.
He practiced a specific form of Islam called Salafi. Isn't Wahhabism a modern version of Salafi?
Well,
I'm just wondering whether that's one of the, because Wahhabism has been a major concern.
Let's put it this way. Wahhabism is to Salafism as baptism is, Baptists are to Christianity or Protestantism. Mm-hmm. Salafia is a, is widely practiced all over the world. It's a, it began as a reform movement at the turn of the 20th century, and was associated with clerics and who were seeking to modernize, actually, and progressivize, and to rid Islam at that point of a lot of tenets that had accreted over the centuries.
Now, you said that Muhammad Gharib was arrested and then disappeared. Was he deported?
I'm sorry. He was arrested and transported to York County Prison. He never returned home.
Oh, so he's still in prison. But weren't some people?
He was eventually deported. He was never charged with any crime. He was held in prisons for over a year and then deported.
And he wasn't the only one. Others were deported and others were held in prisons. Other congregants, were any charges ever made?
There were charges against a couple. They were essentially immigration charges that federal authorities used to remove them from the country.
Was any crime ever uncovered as a result of the raid?
As a result of the raid, no.
So, but the mosque didn't close immediately after the raid. I'm assuming that it was seriously affected by it. Is it still around?
No, the mosque eventually closed. It was crushed by this raid. The raid really was, a very high point in a campaign that against this mosque. And I should say that I use this mosque not. I tell the story of this mosque as a way of telling the story of many, many mosques in this country and of Islam in America after 9/11. Following 9/11, there were enormous numbers of interrogations of Middle Easterners. We all remember this. At Ansarallah, it was a mosque that was founded actually right in the wake of 9/11. And in 2002, toward the end of 2002, congregants told me that they got the sense that they were being watched. And there were no charges ever brought at that time. No one was ever swept up in any kind of raid. But you may recall that in the fall of 2002, the Immigration and Naturalization Service launched a program called Special Registration. It was actually called the National Security Entry and Exit Registration System, called Special Registration. It applied to two dozen primarily Muslim countries and North Korea, and it required all those visitors and or residents here from those countries to go through a very complex series of interviews and fingerprintings and meetings with immigration authorities. And failure to comply with this complex set of regulations was a deportable offense. And so as a result of that, a lot of people ended up in the immigration system facing deportation orders. And not surprisingly, immigration authorities then used those deportation orders to suggest that, well, perhaps we can do something for you if you do something for us. So large numbers of informers began to fan out throughout Middle Eastern communities all over the country.
My guest is Stephen Salisbury, whose book, Muhammad's Ghosts, An American Story of Love and Fear in the Homeland, is published by Nation Books. The raid occurred 6 years ago in May 2004, not a lot closer to 9/11. Do you think things have relaxed a bit in the intervening 6 years?
Well, things were, for Muslims in America, things were very intense right after 9/11, as they were for all of us. Probably 5,000 people were detained. At least 5,000 people were detained in the wake of those attacks. Tens of thousands of people were interrogated, and I would say, estimates. It's very difficult to put a figure on it, but estimates range upwards to 60,000 people were deported. Now, we're not in that situation anymore.
Well, a mosque is scheduled to be built near the World Trade Center site, despite protests from local residents and some of the family members of people who died on 9/11. Do you see that decision by the local community board as something that suggests attitudes are changing? There's less of a hysteria in this country?
I can't really speak to that because I'm not familiar with that particular situation. It struck me as a wonderfully American idea to take this spot which had been destroyed by these extremists and to make it essentially a spot that is would be a monument to American freedoms and religion.
In looking at this story, is Philadelphia a special case among American cities because it bombed its own citizens in 1985 when it attacked the MOVE organization?
Well, Philadelphia actually, yes, that's certainly true. That was, I remember that day very, very well. It was a horrible occasion. With regard to 9/11, Philadelphia actually has been fairly restrained. The local police have been very aware that they need the cooperation of the Muslim American community in that city in order to do their jobs and protect the whole city, protect everyone. I think that hasn't always been the case in other cities.
My guest is Stephen Salisbury, whose book, Muhammad's Ghosts, An American Story of Love and Fear in the Homeland, is published by Nation Books. We'll continue our conversation after we take a little break. Stay with us. We're back with Stephen Salisbury. His book, Muhammad's Ghosts, An American Story of Love and Fear in the Homeland, is published by Nation Books. And throughout your book, you draw parallels between the behavior of government officials today and what we saw in the last half of the 20th century, from the Red Scare of the McCarthy era into the Vietnam War protests. You see parallels between the Red Scare and what's happening right now in the way the government is dealing with Muslims or the public relates to Muslims?
Oh, absolutely. I think that that what we're seeing now with it's simply terrorism has replaced communism. And just as with the Red Scare of the 1950s, there was probably an element of truth in it. There's an element of truth here. But the question is, how much? I think the hysteria is way overblown.
Well, there was a CNN report of a document that reports the number of attempted attacks on the U.S. is at an all-time high. So, and we've seen a couple of rather scary ones. Luckily, the incompetence prevented some terrible tragedies from occurring.
Well, there are just actually two studies of this very issue that have come out in the last few months, one by the RAND Corporation, which, of course, is partially funded by the federal government, and another out of researchers at Duke and the University of North Carolina, also partially funded by the federal government and the Justice Department. Both of those reports analyzed the incidence of terrorism and radicalization in the United States. Both of them come to the conclusion that the problem is serious, and I'm not saying it's not serious. I'm not saying that we shouldn't be aware that this is something that could be very, very dangerous. But both of them come to the conclusion it's been blown way, way out of proportion.
And you're suggesting that examples of the sort that we're discussing here, the raid on a mosque where there was no reason to be suspicious of anyone, are the result of something else going on. Your father was Harrison Salisbury, the Pulitzer Prize-winning New York Times reporter and editor. And didn't he come under suspicion of the U.S. government?
Well, virtually his entire reporting career, he was spied on by either the FBI or the CIA or the National Security Agency.
Did they suspect him of being a subversive in some way?
Well, it grew out of really two things. There was one, actually, that preceded the Second World War, in which he was informed on by a neighbor as being a covert German agent who was a code expert in the employ of the United Press wire agency.
So now he's at that point he was a Nazi.
Yeah, at that point he was a Nazi. Later, after he reported extensively from the Soviet Union for several years and. His FBI and CIA files indicate that he's a communist dupe, an idea that was resurrected when he went to Hanoi during the height of the Lyndon Johnson's bombing campaign there and reported the widespread destruction of non-military targets, including schools, churches, and hospitals. And that set off a... alarm bells all over the administration.
Now, you said that the Philadelphia police are very sensitive to...
Oh, absolutely.
To, I guess we would call this ethnic profiling. This was an FBI raid?
Well, it was a Joint Terrorism Task Force, which is these are groups of drawn from many different agencies across the federal government. They also involve local police. They can even involve... in different districts, campus security officers from universities. This one was seemed to be led by the FBI, but in fact it was difficult to determine that, as I tried to indicate before. The IRS had a hand in it as well.
And you're also suggesting here that while there have been raids like this, very few potential terrorists have been sniffed out.
That's right. There were none here. None here at all. Yet this mosque was destroyed. Parents were separated from children. People were deported. Marriages were crushed. It was an awful experience. It was a disaster for everyone involved.
So if they denied that the raid on the mosque had any connection to a terrorism investigation, but wound up arresting a whole bunch of people, what happened after the dust settled? How did they explain things?
Well, it became simply an immigration matter. I obtained some documents that had been filed with the immigration courts that where the FBI asserted that the mosque had a hidden terror training room, and there were AK-47 rifles in the basement, and the FBI was investigating to see whether or not this involved any connection to terrorism. Well, what else would it involve? But the fact of the matter is, there were no rifles. There was no terror training room. This was simply a rumor that had been. Other members of the congregation were aware of this rumor. In fact, they thought it was a planted rumor. Now, this is what happens when you have large numbers of informers in a community. One person starts a rumor, and then it becomes whispered down the lane. And so you have a situation where a federal informer or a local police informer, someone plants a rumor, starts a rumor, and eventually goes around the circle and comes to another federal or law enforcement informer who reports it back as, hey, there's something going on here. We'd better check it out.
You mentioned that Mohammed Gurab was the mosque sheikh. He was an Egyptian immigrant.
Right.
What did the FBI tell him why they were arresting him?
Well, he was arrested on an immigration violation. He had...
They said that his marriage had been a scam?
Yes, yes, even though everyone associated with him, plus his wife, denied that, but they did not even want to talk to her. They interviewed his wife's two sons by another marriage, one of whom was 15, the other 17, without her knowledge, without her permission. They were having their own problems with local law enforcement, and Gurab was seeking to instill a little discipline in their lives, and they didn't like him. So they were very happy to do whatever they could to get rid of him, and they succeeded. But his former wife was absolutely infuriated by this and very upset. But they would not even interview her or allow her to attend any of his hearings. And once
this is his second wife.
This is his first wife.
Oh.
He then was married. He then
to Maryam Mooman.
Yeah. And they were deeply in love. She's an American citizen. And they had a baby. And she had another daughter by her first marriage. And when Gurab was deported, the older daughter refused to leave the country. She was the daughter that saw him being arrested in front of her school and classmates who were... relentless in harassing her about her father, the drug dealer, her father, the terrorist. It destroyed her life. This is a 13-year-old girl. She refused to leave the country, which put her mother in an absolutely impossible situation. Does she go with her husband, whom she deeply loves and who deeply loves her, or does she stay with her daughter in this country and try to help her come to terms with this awful thing that's happened? She had a breakdown. It was horrible.
My guest is Stefan Salisbury, whose book, Mohammed's Ghosts, An American Story of Love and Fear in the Homeland, is published by Nation Books. Were you able to speak with Gurab before he was deported to Egypt?
I never spoke to Gurab directly. He was kept in isolation for long periods of time.
Had you already started working on the book at that point?
Well, I had started coming around the mosque. I hadn't decided to do a book at all. It took a long, long time to get people to open up to me because they didn't trust me. Why should they? I was an outsider, a non-Muslim. I said I was a writer and a journalist and a reporter. Why should they believe me?
You could have been an undercover
cop or a snitch or anything else
yeah. like that.
Yeah.
So how long did it take you to convince them that they
Well, it took several
could
months. It took several months, and it took as the mosque collapsed and as the war on terror kind of kept grinding on and on, people kept moving around. It's one of the features of Muslim communities in the last several years that people don't stay put. They don't keep their cell phones. They don't have landlines. They don't, if there's any possible issue in their lives, they don't want anyone to know where they are, any outsider, including me. So it took quite a while. Gurab was in prison. He doesn't speak much English. I spoke to him through other people, but never directly. And now he was deported to Egypt in 2000, end of 2005, beginning of 2006, and he's still there. He's been unable to find a job. His life has been ruined.
It's easy to say that the police shouldn't violate the privacy of American Muslims or any Americans, but we've had all these cases in recent months. The two I mentioned earlier were a Nigerian national tried to blow up a plane of a Detroit in Christmas. Faisal Shahzad attempted to detonate a bomb in Times Square just last month. We also had a plot by people, where was it, from Denver to blow up the New York City subway system. How do we balance the desire to nip these things in the bud? After all, in the case of Umar Farouk Abdul Muttalib, he should have been on a no-fly list, and we shouldn't have even had that problem. But some people would have seen that as an invasion of his privacy.
Well, I'm not prepared to argue that, but you take those three cases that you just mentioned. Not one of those cases involved information provided by informants in this country. The Zazi case, the guy who from Denver, the government was tipped off by Pakistani intelligence, and then the only informer who got caught up in that case was a guy who here in New York City, who was a NYPD informant who was caught between what he felt was his duty to the NYPD to, you know, pass information back to them, and his loyalty to his own people and his desire to help them. Now, what happened with him was that he's the guy who supposedly tipped off Zazi that the feds were watching him. Why did he do that? He did it because he didn't want Zazi to get in trouble, and he didn't want to alienate his Afghan community. At the same time, he didn't want to alienate law enforcement officials. So he was caught between a rock and a hard place, and he got nailed, and he's been deported. That's that case. The Detroit case, the man's father went to the embassy in Nigeria and said, I'm worried about my son. He seems to have gone off the deep end, and the government blew him off. They didn't pay any attention. In the third case, with the SUV, there was no informant activity there at all. Both the bomber in Detroit, the so-called underwear bomber, and the SUV here in Times Square were stopped by alert citizens. And I should also point out that the SUV case here in Times Square was reported initially by a Muslim vendor, a man who has been oddly absent from the calls of heroism that went down to two other vendors here in New York.
You have covered a wide range of stories over the years: the Pennsylvania prison system, unrest in Ireland and Eastern Europe, the coup in Turkey, the culture wars in the United States. But why write a book about this? Not that this isn't an important subject.
Well, in the immediate wake of 9/11, I was writing a lot about the impact of the attacks on our physical landscape and the proliferation of surveillance and sort of defensive devices deployed around the city, and I was particularly concerned with downtown area, you know, the Jersey barriers, the cameras, all this stuff that was changing the way people lived their daily lives. And I began to wonder what was happening on darker streets and more out of the way, non-public places to actual human beings. And I started going around to different mosques in Philadelphia, and everyone said, "We don't know what's going on up at that little mosque up in Frankfurt, but maybe you should check it out."
It's interesting that New York seems to be the favorite target of potential terrorists, and yet All over the country, we're seeing these kinds of activities. I don't know whether you have a lot of closed-circuit cameras being put up all over Philadelphia, but it's happening
absolutely.
In cities across the country.
Absolutely. I have about four blocks to walk from the offices of the Philadelphia Inquirer to the train station. And there were, I think, there was one camera there 10 years ago. Now there are 15. It's very much of a fact of life. The question is, what happens to those images? The SUV bombing, car bomb effort is a good example, because that was caught on video and pictures of the wrong guy were flashed all over.
Yeah, we all thought it was the man who was taking his shirt
right,
off.
Exactly.
Stephen Salisbury's book is Muhammad's Ghosts, An American Story of Love and Fear in the Homeland. It is published by Nation Books, and I want to thank you so much for being with us today on our show.
Thank you very much.